Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Greg Combe back at the Sydney Institute. I think he was last here in 2004. I'll introduce the minister briefly. He studied engineering at UNSW and economics at Sydney University. He was a mining engineer, worked for the Waterside Workers Federation, had positions at the ACTU, including assistant secretary from 1996 to 2000 and secretary from 2000 to 2007. As you all know, Mr. Combe's been the MP for Charlton since 2007. Immediately after the election, he was appointed Parliamentary Secretary for Defence Procurement. And in more recent times, he's been the Minister for Defence Personnel, Material and Science, and the Minister assisting the Minister for Climate Change. He's a very busy Minister, and we're very grateful he's found time to talk for the Sydney Institute tonight in his defence capacity. And the topic is From Collins to Force 2030, The Challenge of the Future Submarine. Greg Combe, you're very welcome.
Thanks very much for that, Gerard, and thank you to the Sydney Institute for inviting me back, and welcome to everyone. I hope you are submarine enthusiasts, because it's rather an acquired interest that I'm going to be talking to you about, but I hope you find it interesting from a number of angles. As Gerard mentioned, I've got a couple of portfolio roles, one of which is to assist Senator Penny Wong in the portfolio of climate change. And I'm more than happy, if you have any questions in relation to that area, I'm happy to deal with them or endeavour to address them in question time after I've finished addressing you. But I am here in my other capacity as the Minister for Defence, Personnel, Material and Science, which involves the evaluation of defence capabilities and the development of strategies for their procurement and sustainment over their life for the Defence Force. And I am going to focus specifically on submarines this evening, dealing, I suppose, in a thematic way about lessons that the government and the Defence Force has learnt from the experience of the Collins-class submarine, but also addressing a number of the challenges that we face in going forth with a project to develop the next generation of submarines, something about which I'll describe obviously in a bit more detail. To get on with it, submarines represent a very challenging set of demands in all of the fields in which you could imagine defence procurement takes place, that is, in relation to the people and the skills that are needed to successfully embark upon such a program and ensure its success, the acquisition and procurement strategy, and the science which is involved. The Future Submarine Project is itself perhaps, I think, fair to say, at the margins of our present scientific and technological capacity. This project, the development of the next generation submarines for the Australian Defence Force, for the Navy, will require every bit of scientific, technological and industrial capacity that this country can muster. And we will inevitably require assistance from our allies for the project to succeed. So for that reason, I thought it might be interesting, and obviously it's of relevance to the government, to set out some of this information at this point in time early in the consideration of the project. But I hope it'll be somewhat interesting for you to see this evening, even if you're not at the moment submarine enthusiasts. Perhaps I can set you on the right path. I've become more interested and enthusiastic in recent times. A little bit firstly about the history of Australia with submarines, though, I think puts it in some context, because just on 100 years ago, Andrew Fisher, who was Australia's second Labor Prime Minister, introduced legislation to create the national defence capabilities that would be tested a mere 5 years later in the First World War. Only 2 years before Fisher, Alfred Deakin, against the advice of his Commander of Commonwealth Naval Forces, Captain William Creswell at the time, had decided that Australia would purchase a force of 9 submarines. as costs escalated, the 9 quickly shrank to 2, an early experience of procurement. And on Sunday, the 24th of May 1914, the submarines AE1 and AE2 completed their record-breaking journey from Portsmouth, of course, in the UK, to Sydney. Following the loss of submarine AE1 near Rabaul, on the 14th of September 1914, AE2 was in fact dispatched to Suez late that year and then was assigned to the Dardanelle campaign. On the 25th of April 1915, a pretty significant date, of course, as Australian and New Zealand forces were preparing their assault on the beaches of Gallipoli, AE2, in a lesser-known story, slipped through the Dardanelle and into the Sea of Marmara, where a couple of days later she was scuttled, having, as was described, run amok, to the consternation of the Turks at the time, but overall not inflicting too much damage. And thus ended Australia's first experiment with submarines, an experiment that it would take some 5 decades to repeat. World War II saw submarines, of course, then come into their own as a military force. With John Curtin as our Prime Minister, Fremantle, which he represented in Parliament, with 170 submarines home-ported there, became the second largest operating base for the US, UK and Dutch forces fighting in the Indian and Pacific Oceans. And following the war, the Royal Navy continued to maintain a submarine squadron in Australia. It's quite extraordinary if you see some photographs of the Port of Fremantle at the time. And again, it's not a particularly well-known fact, but there were an enormous number of submarines in that port during the war. Advances in submarine technology, together with dramatic changes in the operating complexity of surface fleets, led to the recognition after the war that submarines would be a significant strategic asset. Accordingly, in 1963, the Naval Board decided to re-establish the Australian Submarine Service with the purchase of 4, and then later 6, Oberon-class submarines. Now, these were highly effective vessels, and they laid the foundation for the submarine force that we have today. And, of course, on that front, the origin of the Collins-class was in 1985, when the then Defence Minister, Kim Beazley, commissioned a major review of Australia's defence needs, and in 1986 the Hawke government initiated the Collins project to deliver 6 state-of-the-art submarines based on a successful Swedish design from Kockums for the Swedish Navy. The technological and industrial achievement of the Collins project was in fact immense. There's been, of course, much media conjecture about the Collins submarines, of course, over a long period of time in this country, but it was an immense achievement. It's a matter of considerable regret, in my opinion, that public confidence in the Collins class was undermined by the political attack from the Howard government in the late 1990s, just as the submarine was proving its formidable war-fighting abilities in international combined exercises coordinated by the United States. Now, given the fundamental importance of our submarine force, this has in fact been very damaging, I think. Public confidence in the defence force is especially important, as is the perception of our strength in the international community. In May this year, the Rudd government released the 2009 White Paper, and this outlined a force structure, Force 2030, we called it, that will enable Australia to meet the strategic challenges of a rapidly changing region. The White Paper reaffirmed the long-held view that the primary task of the ADF, the Australian Defence Force, is to deter and defeat armed attacks against Australia. To this end, the White Paper recognises that the aim of establishing sea and air control in our primary operating environment does not entail a purely defensive or reactive approach. Rather, we must be able to conduct proactive combat operations at a distance from our shores. This demands a mix of intelligence, defensive and strike assets to ensure both deterrence, and if that were to fail, an ability to impose unacceptably high costs on any potential adversary. Put simply, we need to be able to take warfare to an adversary's front door, and submarines are a very important mechanism to achieve that. Excuse me. The White Paper identified the need for Australia to develop and maintain a force that has a capability advantage and which can provide protection against strategic uncertainty. Submarines are able to stop an adversary from deploying its fleet by maintaining sea denial. By imposing disproportionate costs on an adversary, submarines represent what is called an asymmetric threat well suited to this country's defence. Now, the Rudd government has announced its decision to acquire 12 next-generation submarines. The future submarine builds on our experience with the Collins class and aims to offer greater range, endurance and payload. As I noted earlier, this is an extraordinarily complex task, imposing groundbreaking demands on both science and industry. But the government is confident that Australian industry can once again rise to the occasion, as it did with the Collins project 25 years ago. But it's important to recognise that the future submarine's development and its delivery is intimately dependent on our continuing ability to manage, to crew and to operate the Collins-class submarines. As they now approach their middle age, the Collins submarines are throwing up, as you may have seen in recent media coverage, a series of engineering and operational problems that impose real demands on the Navy, the Defence Materiel Organisation, which looks after their sustainment, and the Australian Submarine Corporation, now called ASC, which is the contractor directly responsible for Collins' sustainment. Now, the government is working closely together with all of those organisations to address the problems that we currently have. The Navy is currently examining ways, too, of building up the submarine personnel force in order to ensure that the future submarine is properly crewed. The DMO, that's the Defence Materiel Organisation that I'm responsible for, is looking to the improvement of its contract management to ensure that the technical problems that Collins confronts from time to time can be managed more quickly and better. And the ASC is about to take on a new CEO, an appointment that will be particularly important for the future of the organisation. So within all of that context, I'd like to now highlight some of the more specific challenges that we face with the submarine project. I think it is a matter of genuine national interest. It's a very substantial undertaking, and I'll particularly make reference to my own areas of responsibility in the defence arena, including industry involvement, acquisition strategy, personnel and science. Firstly, to the industrial challenge. So without a doubt, the key challenge for the future submarines will be the industrial challenge. And it also presents, I think, the greatest opportunity for the program. The challenge to the industry, or to industry generally, covers facets of the design, construction and the eventual sustainment of the submarines. Now, the government's carefully considering the issues that are raised under each of the phases in order to inform the acquisition strategy to be utilised for the program. And the first part of that is the challenge of coming up with a submarine design. A constant criticism of the Collins experience was the decision to design a submarine around an evolved Kockums platform, that is the Swedish submarine, rather than simply purchase an existing off-the-shelf submarine. And it's worth asking the question, would Australia be in a better situation if it had simply built one of the existing designs offered in the tender competition for Collins, or invited someone else to build it for us? The available evidence, and of course the government's attending to a lot of these questions about the Collins experience at the moment, but I think the available evidence says no. The lead boat of the Dutch submarine design, Walrus, was delayed, which is one of the competitors, was delayed 3 years due to a fire. The British Type 2400, the initial favourite at the time for the tender, suffered a three-year delay due to construction faults and safety concerns. We're not the only ones that have difficulty with submarines. The first Thiessen TR-1700 to be built in Argentina, in fact, was only 52% complete before the project was abandoned. The two HDW, German-designed submarines, which were built in India, were delivered 5 and 6 years late, respectively. It should also be noted that none of these submarines matched the Collins in terms of performance, either then or now. In planning for the future submarine, we need to consider a range of engineering and production solutions, ranging from the acquisition of a military off-the-shelf design, options consistent with the set of procurement reforms that the government and the previous government initiated in the area of defence procurement, and also give consideration to a developmental solution which is designed in this country. Another issue for the Collins was the failure to adequately consider through life support issues in concept, design and construction phases. I recently had the opportunity to visit the US Navy Centre of Excellence for Ships and Ship Systems, which pays a lot of attention to the US submarine programs, at Carter Rock near Washington, and also at Electric Boat in Connecticut. A key lesson that I learnt during those visits was that submarine design development must be very mature before construction commences. In fact, Electric Boat was outlining to me a rule that they describe as the law of 1, 3 and 8. That is, a task that takes an hour in module construction, that is a construction of part of a submarine, takes 3 hours when the hull has been assembled, and 8 hours when the submarine is in the water. And the lesson very clearly from the life of design and construction of submarines in the US is that you better make sure the design is very mature before you even think about cutting a piece of steel. Which brings me to the construction phase. The design and construction of a fleet of 12 new advanced submarines will without doubt be the largest defence acquisition this country has ever contemplated. And I'd go so far as to say that it is possibly the most complex and sophisticated industrial project we have ever pursued in this country. Some commentators have begun to estimate costs of the project in excess of $30 billion. It's too early for such conjecture. However, those estimates give some idea of the potential financial scale of the project depending on what choices are made. And to put that into some perspective, we all know well about the achievement of the Snowy Mountains scheme, and it's bandied about from time to time. The cost of the Snowy scheme in today's dollars is around $7 billion. And the submarine project, as I said, is going to be quite some multiples of that. This project, the submarine project, will be amongst the largest industrial undertakings ever contemplated. If managed properly, in addition to providing the Navy with 12 highly capable submarines, it'll contribute also to the modernisation of Australian manufacturing industry, and it's not an overstatement to make that observation, because submarines are extraordinarily complex systems. For example, each Collins-class sub has over 3,800,000 parts to it, 75 kilometres of cable, 200,000 onboard connections, 23.5 kilometres of pipe, 14,000 pipe welds and 34.5 kilometres of pipe welding. This complexity is akin to the construction of a space shuttle. The construction of the Collins-class submarines in this country provided the catalyst for the very rapid modernisation of significant sections of our manufacturing industry. When the Collins project began, there were only 35 Australian companies certified to the quality levels required for defence work. By 1998, there were 1,500. The Collins construction involved 70 major subcontractors in Australia and overseas. It created over 2,000 jobs, and more importantly, the project drove more than 1,000 Australian companies to achieve the ISO 9000 quality assurance standard. The Hawke and Keating governments sought a minimum local content target at the time of 70% for the platform. This was a very ambitious target compared to the 30% participation that was the defence project average at the time. That this was eventually exceeded is a tribute, I think, to everyone involved. Of the $5.1 billion cost of the original Collins project, that means $4 billion was spent in this country, and a lot of it helping to drive modernisation in manufacturing. However, we've found it difficult to maintain the industrial capacity built around this level of local content. Some of the ongoing maintenance problems of the Collins are driven by this issue. Accordingly, we're giving serious thought to what industrial capabilities must be supported within the country to sustain a project of this nature. And on the issue of the sustainment of the submarines, we should also consider the issues that we'll face in that period after their construction in maintaining them. Sustainment of submarines is a very complex challenge given the complexities of the boats. However, on this front, we've come a long way over the last 25 years. For the Oberon-class submarines, the Navy was dependent upon overseas suppliers for some 85% to 90% of the support and the refit of the first Oberon-class submarine, and it cost in the end, the sustainment phase, 76% of its original purchase price. The maintenance of the Collins-class, while not perfect, has improved much on that performance, but there are still many significant challenges, and simply, we've got to lift the availability of our current submarines and improve our sustainment performance. It's one of the top priorities in my portfolio and of Senator Faulkner's, the Defence Minister, and it's in fact at the top of the list of projects of concerns that I oversee with the Defence Organisation each month. If I could move on to the acquisition and procurement strategy for the next generation submarine, though, because our ability to get on top of the design, construction and maintenance phases will largely determine our acquisition strategy. Studies have shown that 90% of the discretionary decisions that affect the outcome of a project are made in the first 7 to 12% of the project's life. And there are three things at this point in time that we have to be conscious of that we need to get right. We've got to adequately define the operating concepts and requirements for the submarine. The consideration of this must involve a full understanding of the trade-offs between different aspects of the capability. We've also got to develop a sophisticated acquisition strategy that has the flexibility to solve any problems, but which maintains focus on delivering the agreed outcome. And finally, we have to understand the interaction between capability and the acquisition strategy, because it's often the interaction between those two that leads to trouble in a major project. One of the matters that the government will need to tackle early in the project is the need to invest in and develop a sustainable industrial base that's capable of designing, constructing and maintaining 12 large submarines. Now, on this subject, some commentators have recently canvassed the concept of what one would call rolling production. I'll explain what that means in a moment. But although it's far too early for the government to consider a detailed acquisition strategy, what it throws up is that there are two contrasting models which would appear to provide the boundaries within which an acquisition strategy could be designed. For example, you could build 12 identical submarines, and that's quite likely to be the cheapest way to build the future submarine. If you can ensure that you can acquire all the subsystems for each boat, building 12 submarines on the same design allows the builder to make huge savings as they go by learning and improving the cost curve as they mature. However, there are good capability and industrial reasons why a strategy of building 12 identical submarines may in fact be questioned. For instance, it's almost certain when you consider the time frame for constructing 12 subs that the 12th submarine to be delivered will be at least 15 years behind the latest technology. From a technological currency point of view, there may be certain advantages, therefore, to building submarines in particular batches, that is, updating the design, development and the technology periodically during the build program. For example, designing and building in batches has been found elsewhere to support a more sustainable industrial design capability, to support a sustainable skills and maintenance base, leading in turn to a greater capacity to develop a subsequent project and or to carry out and deliver upgrade programs during the life of the submarine. Moreover, to sustain the necessary design and engineering skills, it's critical that we factor in an appropriate throughput. However, on this point, can I make it very clear that no decision has been made as to the strategy to pursue by the government, but building 12 identical submarines or a few batches or blocks is one of the key choices that the government will need to consider. Selecting the right contracting model will also be an essential part of a successful acquisition strategy. The Collins submarines were built using a fixed price contract. A rigid, inflexible commitment to the terms and conditions of the contract set in train many of the subsequent problems in our experience. An adversarial relationship between customer and builder was pretty much enshrined from the early stages. This is not to say that we should not choose a cost-plus contract. I was interested to learn in my recent trip to the United States, though, that even the Pentagon is moving away from cost-plus contracts. And in the US defence industry, this is a big issue. The United States, by and large, procures in the defence industry on a cost-plus basis, and that's been particularly important for the enablement of industry to invest the necessary funds in research and development, because effectively it's been underwritten by government. However, the Pentagon, on the recent experience and the discussions I was having over there just a few weeks ago, has decided on an alternate course. And for many projects, when the acquisition is in a more mature phase, they're now moving to a fixed price. So there's no hard and fast rule with this, but you've got to be looking at the implications of your contracting structure in any such project as this. One of the lessons, too, from the Collins build was that there was a must be very close cooperation between the Navy, the project manager, the combat systems integrator and platform builder. And I'm therefore closely following the alliance structure that we have set up for the construction of Australia's new destroyers, the air warfare destroyers in Adelaide, which is based upon a cooperative alliance model. There's also, as I indicated earlier, an issue, of course, about the people challenge, if you like, for the submarine workforce, because it's fundamental, to state the obvious, to the successful prosecution of a project and operation of a submarine force. Demographic trends indicate that Australia's population, as you all know, is getting older. Accordingly, defence may face increasing competition for young recruits, particularly those in high-skilled and technical occupations. And we've got to therefore focus on retaining good people while at the same time continuing to attract quality candidates across all of the services. And the submarine force is one area where significant improvement is needed. Navy continues to experience shortfalls in qualified submariners. For any of you that have had the opportunity to go on a submarine, you get some inkling as to why. It's a significant vulnerability, in fact, as the Navy transitions from the Collins class to the new submarine. Now, to address these shortfalls, or to help do so, the government's budgeted for additional positions to support the future maritime force. And I'd like to touch on some of the reasons for the shortfalls we're experiencing and how we intend to resolve them. While the life of a submariner can be one of excitement and professional satisfaction, and I've met many who profess that to be the case, it's not without many challenges. Recent reviews undertaken by the Navy confirm some systemic problems within the workforce that have impacted upon morale and job satisfaction and consequently on retention. As the Minister for Responsible for Defence Personnel, these are issues of concern. The issues include insufficient support to families, a lack of posting stability, high stress, extreme fatigue, and widespread concerns about the sustainability of the current submarine force. There's also been difficulty in finding the right balance between the need to conduct effective training at sea and the need for respite while on shore. We also shouldn't underestimate anecdotal community perceptions that a career at sea is unappealing. Unfortunately, some young people may be quickly discouraged from a life in the Navy by the prospect of what they see as long periods away from family, friends and broader social networks. Now, the Navy and the government are committed to developing a positive cultural shift and enhanced employment conditions that we believe will help stabilise the submarine workforce over time. Our key advantage, as we see it, is the unique nature of military work, which comes with a comprehensive package of pay, conditions and services. I'd be proud of it if I was achieving it as a union official, I can suggest to you. In short, though, the ADF I believe to be a tremendously rewarding profession, and the submarine workforce is an extremely specialist one that I think can bring a lot of satisfaction. Through sensible recruitment and retention measures, we can build a framework for a more sustainable workforce culture, and that's what we'll work towards. I'd like now finally to turn to the science challenge that we face with the future generation submarine, because it is another challenge for the future submarine to lock in the scientific support that will be critical to the long-term sustainability of the project and the subs in their operational life. If Force 2030 is to have a capability edge over other forces, we must have submarines with advanced technology and systems. There's little point investing this quantum of money if we don't achieve that outcome. This capability edge will be science-driven. And to this end, this country is very fortunate indeed to have the Defence Science and Technology Organisation, which is also a responsibility that I represent within the defence portfolio. The DSTO provided research in all phases of the Collins submarine build, and it's highly regarded internationally. It played a vital role in the development of a new high-strength, low-alloy steel. on the Collins. The consistency offered by this steel and the ability to weld it was an essential element in the successful construction of the Collins-class submarines, in fact. Just as significant was the DSTO's development of advanced anechoic tiles that render the submarine invisible to enemy sonars and are at the leading edge of stealth technology. The DSTO also made an invaluable contribution to the development of the active sonar for the Collins. The DSTO was also instrumental in identifying the propeller and water flow around the hull as key drivers of the noise problems that affected Collins after launch. The US Navy's Centre of Excellence, that I mentioned before, at Carterock near Washington, has also provided invaluable support for the Collins and will be highly dependent on the US to provide science and technology support for the future submarine to succeed. We need to start early on developing the science to underpin the future sub, and we've already begun investing in these efforts. And the government's recently invested $1 million in a new underwater test facility, for example, that will be used for experiments to control underwater noise. The DSTO has also partnered with the Australian Maritime College to develop world-class hydrodynamic facilities that will also be important. The DSTO is also looking at a range of additional technologies that will be key drivers of future submarine operation, things such as energy storage, payload deployment, communications and autonomous systems, air-independent propulsion and submarine habitability. All of these fundamentally important aspects of a successful next-generation submarine. So the DSTO has a fundamentally important role to play. And finally, what I describe as the management challenge for a successful project. Project management performance during the design and construction of the Collins class was, I think, fair to say, variable. The project management unit was split between Canberra and Adelaide, with the prime contractor, of course, being located in Adelaide. This led to poor communication at times, with issues taking longer than they should have to resolve. It's also fair to say that there was poor risk mitigation and inadequate contingency allocated for the project. There was also insufficient recognition of the parent Navy challenge and an underestimation of through-life support costs. Moreover, the through-life support contract was not in place for the Collins-class submarine early enough. A further issue that the government's mindful of, too, is the need to ensure, in light of the Collins-class experience, that there is clarity over the ownership and utilisation of intellectual property. And in fact, the IP issues with the Collins proved to be one of the most significant stumbling blocks to ensuring their successful deployment. One of the things that the government will need to consider is a dedicated policy cell located in Canberra that could translate the strategic guidance into the actual detailed requirements of the submarine. This will involve a deep understanding of the various trade-offs between the desired capabilities and the impact on cost, schedule and risk. And that debate or dialogue in Canberra is already well underway amongst the defence leadership and within the defence portfolio. Additionally, though, consideration will need to be given to an appropriately resourced design and project management cell located in Adelaide. And this cell must be located in Adelaide, close to the builder, I believe. The government's committed, of course, that the submarines will be built in Adelaide. We've seen the benefits of this approach with the air warfare destroyer project. The ongoing upgrade of the Collins-class subs will also be crucial to the successful management of the future sub, as I indicated earlier. Managing these upgrades well potentially provides a development path to the future submarine. Finally, I hope not so much with your relief, perhaps for me, the future submarine... I'll enter into my conclusion. The future submarine project, I think, as I hope I've given you a flavour of it, is evidently very ambitious. But in the view of the government, it is also an achievable project. The combination of Australian scientific, technological and industrial know-how, the potential technical support from our allies, sound project design and robust contract management should deliver an unparalleled strategic asset. This is a hugely important undertaking. In this enterprise, we will strengthen our ties with the US further, I believe. which places great value on the role that the Royal Australian Navy Submarine Force is able to play in combined operations with the US fleet. The ability of Australia and the US to operate our submarines together, I think, is critical to the project's success. Australia's ability to conduct successful defence operations in theatres distant from our shores will be enormously strengthened by the surveillance, intelligence and strike capabilities of a long-range submarine, and that's what the government plans to deliver. Thank you for your time. I know it's a rather specialist topic, but it's an especially important one, and I think it is also important that the community starts to be more informed about some of the challenges that we face, and so that we can have a mature debate about the issues involved. But thank you very much for the opportunity to listen.
Many thanks, Minister. Thanks also to Gilbert and Turbin for the use of this fine facility this evening. And so we come to questions and discussion, and we'll finish no later than 7 o'clock. Thanks for a very important presentation. You would be aware of some of this duty or period in the ACTU and your more recent period in government. But there was a word around Canberra in the mid-80s that one of the reasons why Kim Beazley was able to sell the Collins-class project to the Hawke government was because it would be essentially put together in Australia. And you've spoken about the importance of having, or the fact that the government's decided on Adelaide, and obviously, again, there's going to be submarines, or 12 submarines on this occasion, put together. So to what extent is this motivated by the best defence outcomes, or to what extent is it motivated by support for Australian industry?
Thanks, Gerard. This is an issue that arises, I think, virtually with every defence procurement, because there are two objectives in many people's minds, and that is, of course, that with the size of the defence acquisition budget and sustainment budget, which is currently running around $10 billion a year, it is obviously significant to Australian industry and to manufacturing in particular. And so that's always an objective of government, to ensure that where it is appropriate and there is a competitive environment within which we can tender for defence procurement and sustainment contracts, it is important to see Australian industry successful in gaining access to that work, because it supports jobs and investment with obvious multipliers in the economy. However, having said that, the single most important factor in any defence procurement decision is the capability that it is intended to deliver for the Australian Defence Force. That is what it is about at the end of the day, ensuring that the Australian Defence Force and the national security of our country is served in a cost-effective manner by the best technology and capability that we can acquire, and the submarine is no different on that front. The white paper laid out, of course, the strategic context. I've painted that very briefly myself also, in which the decision to go forth with the acquisition of 12 next generation submarines has been made, and it is to meet those capability demands and the national security requirements. Of course, that is a major driver. Having said that, any government, as I say, is going to be concerned to ensure that we maximise the ability to generate jobs and economic activity in our domestic economy.
Thanks. I have a question that might be politically incorrect a little bit.
I get them all the time, especially in question time.
Has anybody ever considered, for several countries, like the Americans, the Brits, the Germans and the Swedes, as well as the Australians, get together and build a super-duper submarine?
There's a lot of dialogue in the submarine community, if you like, amongst our allied nations. And of course, they broadly fall into two areas of discussion, nuclear and conventionally powered submarines. And on the conventional side of it, which is a field, of course, that we are in, we have a lot of dialogue with European nations about submarine design and sustainment issues. And recently, of course, we've announced that RAND Corporation from the US will do an assessment of the design capability that we have here. And one of the things, of course, that We've also been mindful of is the extent to which we can draw upon conventional submarine expertise internationally to successfully undertake the project. But also, of course, the US has a lot of experience in designing and building submarines at the facility that I visited in Connecticut. The electric boat facility, combined with Northrop Grumman at Newport News, they're turning out one Virginia-class submarine per year, and it is a monumental undertaking to achieve that. There is a lot of dialogue in the international community about all of the issues involved and whether the extent to which common design ideas and combat systems and the like can be utilised. But every nation, naturally, having said all of that, is going to have a strong interest, and we are no different in this front, in making sure that we've got a design and capability edge, and that we can have a submarine for our national defence and security that's just out there beyond what other countries have. And for that reason, all countries, although there's a good dialogue, are also very mindful of the need to deliver themselves that particular edge.
Okay,
there's
a question. Does Australia choose conventional versus nuclear submarines for political or technical reasons?
There'd be a range of answers to that. Of course, there's been, I think you could describe, a bipartisan view at a political level that we're in the conventional field, not the nuclear field. So that's the political side of it, but that's also informed by pragmatic technical and cost considerations. We don't have a nuclear industry in this country that's necessarily capable of delivering an indigenous nuclear capability for submarine technology. And this particular government is not motivated to so explore it either. We're in the field of conventional submarines. We can do that. We obviously, as I was indicating in the previous answer, very mindful of and interested in developments in conventional submarine propulsion technology and, most importantly, air-independent propulsion. And so that's the field that we'll be exploring.
You spoke earlier about the interests of the United States. To add to that question, is that because the US is essentially into nuclear submarines that therefore there's a benefit in us being into conventional if we're going to cooperate together in the Pacific?
Well, at the end of the day, if we're cooperating with the United States submarine fleet, if we have a highly capable submarine, stealth technology, capable of operating with the United States, it's of enormous advantage with our allies. And whether it's conventionally powered or nuclear, if it can do the job, that's what's important.
Minister, thank you for a fascinating talk. On top of your wish list, what is the greatest scientific breakthrough that you're looking for in order to give you that competitive edge and expand capability that you're looking for in the future?
I think delivering it would be the simple answer. Well, we're talking about a long-range conventional submarine that's potentially larger than the Collins class, and that's a big demand for a conventionally powered submarine. And with all of the other capabilities that have been canvassed in the white paper, the overall project in itself to deliver a submarine with those capabilities is a significant enough challenge, and that's, I guess, at the level that we're working on it now, and we want to make sure that, of course, in the laws of physics, that all of that is achievable. We certainly believe it is, and that's what we're working on. But I guess from my perspective at the moment, it's try and bring all of these particular facets of the project together and as strongly as we can possibly determine it at this early stage when we're laying the foundations for the submarine that'll be operating well beyond at least a number of our lifetime, that we get all these foundations right and that it is achievable. And I am happy if anyone does have any queries, Gerard, to cover anything on the emissions trading scheme too, since I've got a responsibility for that.
So we go, Anne,
as I recall, despite all the criticism of the Collins class sub, they were regarded as it's highly efficient and remarkable for their use in, I think, the shallow waters around some of the Southeast Asian areas of tension. And with that, I wonder, what are you looking for in a submarine for our particular needs? What are the features? I mean, there's so many different kinds of things a submarine can do, I'm sure. But what are we looking for in terms of our defence capability?
Well, I can only really talk about that in general terms, by which I don't mean to be resistant to answering in as full a way as I can, but I think it's more appropriate that I answer it in general terms. But, of course, we're looking for a submarine that has significant endurance, but which is conventionally powered and which is able to carry an enhanced payload, if you like, over what the Collins-class submarine has had. If we're to contemplate air-independent propulsion for a conventional submarine, it demands that the mass of the submarine is significantly greater. You've got to store liquid oxygen on the vessel, demanding a greater displacement in the design, all of which then again has an element of demand on the conventional power that's available for the submarine. And all of that's driven by our need to have long-range capacity for the sub. And if there's one major determinant, that would be one of them, and that's a feature of our geography and, of course, the basing of the submarines. But they are an extremely important, when you have the privilege of working in the role that Senator Faulkner and I currently do, I can only emphasise to you that the submarine force has an extremely important capability for this country, given the national security interests that we have.
Yes, pardon my ignorance on the subject, but with the Collins-class submarine, there were some problems with it, and were there actually any that sank or that had casualties, and how will it continue in the Defence Force with an idea of improvements?
Well, the good thing to report is that we built six and we've still got six. And there's been quite a deal of speculation lately about the operational availability of those six submarines. The other thing to understand, and to put the availability question into some context, is that these really are very complex platforms, and they do enter for a considerable period of time what's called full-cycle docking. And that means that a huge amount of maintenance work, to conventionally describe it, is undertaken. It generally also means that technology is upgraded, combat systems might be upgraded, software is upgraded, a range of things are replaced. And bear in mind, too, that for mechanical issues and the replacement of parts within the submarine, some of which can be very large, you've got a hatch which you've got to, you know, plan in advance. Once a submarine is built, unless you cut it open, everything has to go in and out of a hatch. And the time demands, the complexity of planning, the disassembly of material inside the submarine, its maintenance and its reassembly is enormously time-consuming. And if you've got a fleet of six submarines, there are going to be a number of those at any one time in a significant period of docking, and that's what we have at the moment. But they have been very effective and successful. I met the commander of the US Pacific Submarine Fleet last year, who has been engaged in exercises with the Collins class, and he said what is already on the public record, that it is a tremendously capable boat. And it is an achievement that we can be proud of.
Okay, so we go over here and then here and then here. Yes?
I'm interested in your special role with respect to the two bottlenecks that you have, and with respect to the government's commitment to an emission trading scheme that was to follow in Copenhagen. Do you see yourself as being having a special interest in introducing energy efficiency to the Australian Defence Forces, especially with respect to procurement?
Well, I get asked that occasionally, and it's a good question because defence is a fairly major consumer of energy. And I think probably my best answer is that there's a way to go on that front yet. There's an awareness of the issues, but I think we can probably do a good bit more. Defence is an area where I think we cannot you know, without proper planning and dependence upon a strategy for the energy resources of the ADF, we can't, in a clumsy way, go forward and start to think we're going to make significant change quickly. The ADF needs to be absolutely confident that it has the energy resources that it needs to be able to deploy and do the work that is required of it. And you see that now and on a regular basis. We've seen recently, of course, we need to respond very rapidly to natural disasters within the region. We've got major demands in the Middle East and elsewhere. And so they are occupying the main attention. The principal thing that I think as a nation we've got to do is to get a carbon price into our economy and start to shift the investment decisions into lower carbon technologies.
Yes, Mr. Connor, thank you very much. I was actually shifting a bit to the climate change side. We've got a few minutes left to go. And just would invite you to make a bit of a comment, your observations, how you're feeling about our current state of preparedness and the confidence that we have, the plans that we have in place both nationally and at the multilateral level coming into Copenhagen are actually going to have the impact that we need against the backdrop of perhaps societal ennui or weariness of the topic has become a little bit less, apparently a little bit less in the forefront of people's minds, just at the time that some really difficult decisions have to be made.
Yes. I think if you look at this in historical context, and assuming that you accept the climate science, which the government does, we're not quibbling about the consensus view of the international scientific community on climate change. We believe it, and we believe we have a responsibility to act upon it. In that context, an emissions trading scheme is without any doubt one of the, if I think it's the most, significant economic and environmental reform that a government has undertaken in this country. It is complex, that is true, but it is enormously significant from an economic standpoint and an environmental standpoint. It is appropriate, therefore, that it does have extensive attention in public policy debate. The quality of the debate might vary, of course, and focus a lot on politics, but nonetheless, the issue itself needs to be properly and thoroughly ventilated, because it is a very important reform. In terms of our preparedness, on all of the experience I've now had in the portfolio and the interest I've taken in it, which isn't as extensive as some others, the emissions trading scheme that we've called the Carbon Pollution Reduction Scheme that we have for the second time now before the House of Representatives is a comprehensive policy response to this issue of ensuring that we import a carbon price into the economy. It is intended that that carbon price be set by the marketplace via the trading of permits under the scheme. And for those of you less familiar with these concepts, a facility such as an electricity power generator which burns coal for the purpose of power generation will have to buy a permit for every tonne of pollution it puts into the atmosphere. And the setting of that price will be according to the market after the first year of the scheme. And, of course, that can involve then many millions of dollars liability, if you like, on that generator to purchase the permits to pollute. It, by putting that carbon price into that facility, it not only affects the output price of the product to the extent it can be passed on, therefore shifting people's utilisation of energy, hopefully conserving energy more and looking for more energy efficient methods. But within the power station itself, it drives changes for energy efficiency. There's one in my electorate that generates about a quarter of New South Wales baseload power. Just the prospect of a carbon price coming in has driven them to refining the design of some aspects of their plant that will deliver, I think, quite significant reductions in pollution. That's certainly what they're projecting, and therefore their liability to buy permits. Like it drives change in investment thinking and in culture, but also what this is going to do is to drive investment further into lower polluting forms of energy generation. And I've had the opportunity now of spending a lot of time with many different industries affected by the emissions trading scheme, and I can tell you it is driving change already. The thing is that we need to prosecute the piece of legislation through the Parliament, get it through, get it into place, and on my experience also, and my experience internationally in this field is limited, Senator Wong looks after that side of it in particular, but if we are able to go, I was in the US discussing this only recently, if our government is able to go as one of the highest per capita users of energy and generate highest per capita carbon polluters, if we can go to Copenhagen having said we've got targets and we have legislated a mechanism to achieve our reduced emissions, we will have, I believe, a substantially enhanced negotiating position to encourage others to do the same. You can all sit around waiting for someone else to do things. The fact of the matter is that there is an urgency to this internationally, and I'm hopeful that we'll see a productive outcome from Copenhagen.
So we're getting it in. There's a question here.
Yes, given Australia's success in collecting electronic intelligence from ocean waters for submarines, how effective is Australia denying foreign submarines the same success in Australia?
Well, that's again an area that's probably a little sensitive for me to touch on, but I reckon we've got a pretty good, set of defences for that, for those issues.
Minister, as you've already mentioned, Europe is an electorate that's incredibly emissions intensive, obviously, with lots of jobs and the economy, voters, workers relying on that area of employment.
With very fine representation too, don't you?
I'm sure. How do you reconcile that? Does that colour the way that you engage with the emissions trading scheme? Does it make it more likely for you to adopt the proposed amendments of the coalition as far as each industry protection and electricity sector changes are being proposed?
Well, my personal inclinations one way or the other are irrelevant. I mean, they help inform my input into the discussion within the government, obviously, but these decisions are made by the PM and the Cabinet. At the end of the day, that is our policy stance and approach. I think one of the reasons that the Prime Minister may have asked me to undertake this task, though, might have something to do with my background. That is, I am a coal mining engineer originally. I know the industry well, although I haven't worked in it for quite a long time, but I've maintained contact with it. In my time in the union movement, I had a lot to do with the coal industry, oftentimes not necessarily enamoured on the other side of the table with coal mining companies, but I have known the industry well, and I know the energy generation sector well. In my time as a union official, I represented people across many of those, the industries, aluminium, smelting and others. And the industrial knowledge that I was able to acquire has proven to be very useful in all of the discussions that in which I have been involved. And perhaps that's part of the motivation the Prime Minister had putting me into the role. Having said that, the agenda for the discussions between ourselves and the opposition has been set by the opposition. They are proposing changes to the emissions trading scheme. We're glad that they have. Both sides, I believe, or the leadership of both sides, those involved in it, are approaching it in good faith. The government's very keen to endeavour to reach agreement if we can. However, it's not an agreement in any form or as dictated by Mr Turnbull. It's got to be a good faith negotiation. It has to stack up from a fiscal point of view, from our budget, with our budgetary stance over the forward estimates and beyond. And it's got to stack up from an environmental point of view too. And I'm very mindful of that. The people in my electorate, which include many, many coal miners, electricity workers, people at aluminium smelters and other industries with high levels of emissions intensity, I think have been fantastic. They understand the issues well. I know the coal miners union, obviously, very, very well, and they have been one of the leading advocates for an emissions trading scheme and for Australia to get on top of this issue and to take other measures, invest in carbon capture and storage, because they recognise that their medium and long-term job security depends to a significant degree upon the quality of our response to climate change. And so I've found it to be, you know, a really good balance, in fact.
Minister, that's fine. I think we'll leave it there because we're right on 7 o'clock and it's a good question and a good answer to finish on. Thank you. Take a seat for a second and I'll be very brief. it was good to get an update on how the negotiations are going. So I think that's a good way to end on. There are more questions here. I'm sorry, we took a lot of questions tonight, but we always finish on time. So I'd just like to briefly thank Greg Conway for coming back to the Sydney Institute. It's a significant speech tonight because obviously the building in Australia of 12 new submarines is a hugely important decision and a hugely important operation into the future. And it's great that the Minister gave one of his first major speeches on the submarine matter at the Sydney Institute. Greg Conway is obviously one of the clear successors of Kevin Rudd's government, and we've seen here tonight one of the reasons why he's done so well in politics after an important career in the trade union movement. So thanks for coming along tonight, and I'm sure we'll ask you back in the future, and I'm sure you have more significant speeches to give, so thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.